week, if you recall, Paul is in Roman custody. Lysias, who is the commanding officer of the Roman troops, wanted to resolve the issue that had occurred between Paul and these Jewish leaders. And so he called a meeting, and because of Paul's instigation during that meeting, the Sadducees and the Pharisees blew up at one another over the issue of the resurrection. And in the midst of the melee, Lysias commanded his soldiers to get Paul out of the mix, take him by force, get him back in the barracks. Paul, kind of feeling defeated, for in that meeting, he definitely had reacted in the flesh. Nonetheless, we're told in the scriptures that the Lord stood by him, and he let Paul know that he would be going to Rome to testify for the Lord. And we pick up in verse 12 of Acts chapter 23. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy, and they went to the chief priests and elders, and they said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we're ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and he brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who've bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they've killed him. And now they're ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him to tell no one that you've informed me of these things. And then he called two of the centurions and he said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also, provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. It's a big section. You're probably wondering, how in the world are we going to get through that section today? It's an interesting, it's a narrative section, and there's not an awful lot of prescription in this section. But it hit me as I was preparing this week, something that kept coming back, and especially even last night. And so even last night I went online, looked at a couple of news sites. I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but I've noticed in the past few years, more than any other in my lifetime, that it seems to be that we're bombarded with an endless news cycle that contains one great event after another, and it just seems like one greater threat and another greater threat and another greater threat, and it just seems like we're being bombarded. And so last night, I just went through and looked in the last week to say, what have we bombarded with? An earthquake in Japan, a bombing barrage of Israel from Hamas, an immediate response. Russia placing offensive troops and weapons on Cuba. North Korea testing missiles again. Venezuela in chaos, and the world is starting to line up with Western countries for Guaido and communist countries for Maduro. Pakistan is killing Christians. China is placing Muslims in concentration camps. Thousands of immigrants are amassing at the U.S. southern border. The Antarctic ice shelf is melting faster than expected. Yet more snowpack in California Sierras than there's been in decades. The U.S. Attorney General is called in to testify in Congress about a U.S. president's alleged treason. Christian persecution around the globe is at the highest peak in history. Rise in hatred of Jews worldwide is increasing, and there's now talk of a Fourth Reich. That's just headlines in the last 7 days, let alone the news of political wins and losses, local news, shootings in San Diego, issues, politics, global crises as nations rise and fall, economies are coming and going, famine, breadlines in other areas, Hollywood, Me Too, woke, social justice, reparations, Antifa, AOC, LGBTQ, cisgender, black holes, meteors, solar flares, robots, Facebook, privacy, bombarded with news going on all around us of things that are scary, things that make us anxious. Seems like a random list, 1 week's history. So what do you do with all of this information? Does it make you anxious? Do you know that we have an entire generation that's being raised, and you know what they're identified by most? I'm an HR guy, and so we look at what drives these generations. You know what drives them most? Anxiety. It's an anxious generation that's growing up right now. Anxious, anxieties, and fear. Some worry. Some prep for the apocalypse that's coming. Some just numb the pain. Some are fatalistic. Some are obsessed with the news. They can't turn it off. One survey showed that people are checking their phones and iPads an average of 30 times an hour. 30 times an hour. What's changed? You know what's sad about checking your phone 30 times an hour? The only reason they keep doing it is because they're rewarded that things change 30 times an hour. You find new stuff to be afraid of 30 times an hour. So this week, as I was struggling with this section that we're in right now, saying, Lord, what do you want me to pull out? What is it that you want me to see? I kept coming back to this. I saw in the passage, as in so many others throughout the scripture, God's writing his story. And you know what we see in his word is he gives us a magnifying glass to get away from all of this the stuff that we see globally. And he allows us kind of through a magnifying glass to come in and see what he's doing in an individual's life as he's following through and tracking with one story that he's basically engaging with. And we start to understand that he's this involved in one story, and you pull it back now and look at all of the things, you know, 30 times an hour, headlines going on, recognizing that our God has his hand in every single one of those stories. Nothing is happening around this planet that is not happening under his control, under his watch, under his knowledge, for his purposes, that will ultimately end up in his glory. Comforting. And so what I wanted to do is for us to take a look at this passage this morning from the vantage point of the reader, the believer, who sees God's divine plan being carried out in God's timing with incredible precision and stunning coordination, oftentimes with amusing irony. As we open this section, I want you to be aware of all of that. I want you to be thinking in the backdrop, all the turmoil that we see going on around the globe and all the stuff that seems like chaos and random and threatening and all the stuff. Put that in the back. Don't turn it off all the way, but just put it in the back. Take out a magnifying glass and with me take a look at this section this morning to see how our God works in one area. One of the things I want you to see as we come into this is an understanding in God's word that our God drives his will through all things. He pushes, he guides, he pulls, he moves. Job 42, he says, what does Job tell God? He says, I know that you can do anything and that no plan of yours can be thwarted. In the Psalms over and over again, it tells us, the psalmist tells us that God does what he pleases. In one place, he even says that he scoffs at man's antics. In Proverbs 16:4, it says, the Lord has prepared everything for his purpose. 16:9, Proverbs tells us that a man's heart plans his way, but the Lord determines his steps. 16:33, it says, the lot is cast, but its every decision is from the Lord. Do you know what that means? It means there's no chance. Not even the roll of a dice is outside of our God's control. He directs leaders' hearts like streams of water wherever he chooses. He himself says in Isaiah, as I have proposed, so it shall be. As I have planned, so it will happen. And so, last week we left with the Lord standing beside Paul in his cell after a hard day. And he stands beside Paul and he tells him what? You got the work done here in Jerusalem. I now have work for you to do in Rome. He doesn't tell Paul exactly how he's going to get him to Rome. He just lets him know Rome is the destination. And what we see now over the next couple of chapters is how God is orchestrating his plan and his purposes to bring Paul to Rome. We know last week the message that we all left with, the one that's encouraged me through this whole week, is that we know that as he stood by Paul, Paul was able to hold on to the promise that God would never leave him. He would never leave his side. He would go with him through everything as he's orchestrating everything around him. And so, we come this morning to this verse, and I want you to read it in that context. It's the next day. And evidently, the Jews are still upset. Undoubtedly, they're irritated that they were so easily agitated. They see that this is a foe that is pretty strong. He's smart. This is a real threat to everything that they hold dear. And so there emerges out of this group a hit squad, a group that's desperate to kill Paul and end this Christ movement, this Jesus way. We need to put it to death and get rid of it once and for all. And so in verse 12, we see the Jews hatch a plot, and they even bind themselves with an oath. They're not going to eat or drink until Paul's dead. You know what that tells you? I mean, these aren't just guys who are idle threats at a bar somewhere going, yeah, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. These are Jews that are connected to the Sanhedrin. These are Jews that take the law of God very seriously. If they take an oath before God, they're dead serious about this. And so what you find when they take an oath saying, we're not going to eat or drink till this is done, one, they're telling you how important it is to them, how committed they are to it, and how fast they're going to work to get it done. So this is a legitimate threat. It's not only serious, it's immediate. They're driven. And verse 13 tells us that this isn't five or six hotheads that are getting together. This is an oath that's sworn to by over 40 Jews. This is a pretty big group that's going to get this done. And not only do they vow to kill Paul fast and soon amongst themselves, they then go to the chief priests and the elders. Notice they don't go to the Pharisees. So what you can understand is this seems to be a Sadducean hit squad. They go to the priests and the elders, and they make their oath official. Can you imagine? That's not just I'm taking an oath with a bunch of my buddies. I'm now going to the chief priest saying, I'm taking an oath in front of you. I'm not going to eat or drink until he's dead. Hold me to that oath. Basically, there's no turning back after that. They're going forward with this. And they just don't tell the leaders, they involve the leaders, right? They bring them in as accomplices. We need your help. We want you to send word to Lysias for another meeting. Tell him you need to get to the heart of the matter. But we tell you this, he'll never make it to that meeting. We'll get him before he gets there. We'll be ready to kill him before he ever comes near to this meeting with you. Then a couple of new folks enter the scene, and all of a sudden we're introduced to Paul's sister and his nephew. Never heard of them before, and you don't hear about them after. It's just kind of Luke says, oh, and by the way, what's interesting is usually the church fathers, I can go to the church fathers, and even though the Bible doesn't tell you, they'll make up a story, you know, to fit. Even they don't make up a story. That's all you get. Paul has a sister, and he's got a nephew, and God uses them here. What's interesting, you've got to understand, is this nephew, when he tells Lysias what is taking place, it's pretty detailed, which tells you that this kid probably heard it firsthand. When you think about who Paul is what? He is a Jew of Jews. He's a Hebrew of Hebrews. He's a Pharisee of Pharisees. And so you can imagine that most of his family members were going to be in the mix of the Jewish area. And so this little boy has very good inside information. We don't know how he gets himself to Paul, everything else. We just know that he does. Basically, he comes into the barracks and he tells Uncle Paul what the plan is. He says, "This is what I heard." What's interesting is then Paul calls out to one of the centurions, one of. The minute you hear that there's more than that, anyone that's been connected to the military, you understand that a centurion is a fairly high-ranking kind of enlisted officer. He's in charge of at least 100 troops. And so when he says one of, there's several hundred troops that are basically stationed here in Jerusalem. And so Paul calls out to one of the centurions and notice something. Paul's quite comfortable in directing the centurion. How often do you think it is that a prisoner is going to go, "Hey, I want you to do this for me"? That's not going to happen when you're under custody with Roman centurions. Not only that, you're not usually going to have a centurion guarding you. But Paul is here close to the centurions enough, and he's comfortable enough that he tells this one, "Take the boy to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." If this was a normal prisoner, the centurion would be going, "Oh, okay, I'll get right on that." But that's not what that centurion does. What he does just as he was told. And we get another uncommon reaction. What I want you to see is these are uncommon reactions. These aren't normal reactions. The centurion's like, "What does he want? What's he going to say? I'm not going to just bring him in to the commanding officer." Anyone who's in the military knows he's not going to go bother in the evening a commanding officer unless he knows what's up. What's this kid going to say? What's this all about? Uncommon reaction. The centurion then brings the boy to Lysias. Lysias, a commanding officer, is gentle with this boy. Another uncommon reaction. Look at what he does. Verse 19, he takes him by the hand, which tells you that this is a boy. This boy's come in, and this tribune takes him by the hand, takes him aside, and he says, "Here, let's go over here and get out of the way of everybody else." I love the way that Luke presents this. Do you know what Luke is letting us see? Paul, one, has made an impression with everyone that he's around. You get a sense from all of these folks that there's at least a respect for Paul, if not an affection. The way in which they're treating Paul is different than they would treat any other prisoner. You also get the impression that God is at work here because you've got uncommon reactions in all of these places. Why do I think that he's got an uncommon reaction, or how is Paul moved into the heart of this Lysias? First interaction, you remember what he says? "You know Greek?" Right off the back, there's a respect. It's like, "You know Greek?" He then allows Paul to speak to the crowds. And what does Paul speak in? Hebrew. So Paul's got multiple languages. He's educated. When the crowd goes crazy, he decides to question Paul through flogging, only to find out he's a Roman with rights. Now he's got bad footing with Paul. Now Paul's got something over on him, but Paul doesn't necessarily seem to be using it. Not only do the centurion step back, we're told that Lysias, the tribune, was afraid. Even this is out of the ordinary. This is going to play out in this role later. God's going to use even this. Why didn't Paul write up front saying, "By the way, I'm a Roman citizen"? Why did he? God's timing in all of this is evident, that there's specific timing, because you needed Lysias to be able to be on bad footing for what Lysias is about to do. Lysias has watched every interaction. He's seen Paul in the council melee, and he orders his troops to rescue Paul and take him out using force. Think about it. This guy has something on you, and these guys are about to kill him, and it's out of your control. What's the best thing that Lysias could do if he was a normal Roman commanding officer? Let him kill him. Problem solved. He's now gone. The Jews are going to be placated. I can take a couple of Jews and hold them accountable and we'll have a trial. All of this can go away. That's not what he does. Not only does he send his troops in, he sends his troops in by force. Basically, get him out of there. Go save this man. Go and rescue him from that group. And so he says, by force, go and extract him out. That's uncommon. That seems to be counterintuitive to what, if you were Lysias, what you'd really want done. And so this evening now, the tribune listens to Paul's nephew privately. And look at what this kid tells him, verses 20 and 21. And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow. And this might have already happened, so that rings true. As though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him, but don't be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who've bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink, till they've killed him, and now they're ready, waiting for your consent. That's pretty detailed information. That doesn't sound like secondhand. And so he gives all of this information to Lysias. First, the boy's got a pretty thorough understanding. But second, think for a moment. Again, there's another opportunity for Lysias to solve his problems. I can make the boy go away. Don't tell this to anybody. And I can honor the Jews' request to have him go. And look what happened. He was killed on the way. How unfortunate. Problem solved. But we have another uncommon reaction. He does let the boy go, and he tells the boy not to tell anyone else about this, right? He says, don't even tell anybody that you told this to me. And then look at what he does. And I want you to understand this is a big deal. This is something that I got really into detail with. I told Davis yesterday, only a third of you are going to care as much as I do about this section, but too bad you're going to listen because I think it's really cool. He calls in two of the centurions, each of a leader of approximately, he said two of, which tells you there's more. Each of those guys has at least 100 soldiers reporting to them. He calls them in. And what does he tell them? This is evening. I want you to understand this is just probably after dusk. And he calls them in. He says, I want you to make ready your men, which is basically saying, I want to go get all of your 200 guys and get them ready to go right now. I want you to bring 70 cavalry. That's a lot of work. I want you to get 70 cavalry, 70 horsemen ready. And I want you to bring 200 spearmen. Spearmen. I went and looked that up. This is pretty cool. This is significant. You know what spearmen did in the Roman army? They were the tip of the spear. When there was a blockade or when there was something that they had to get through that was people, they brought in spearmen. Spearmen are the ones you see in the movies that kind of link arms and they all have spears and they move as one. And it's almost like a weapon because they come in and they basically mow down anything in their way. And as the ones up front get killed, they're used as barricades. They climb up over them with spears and it just keeps progressing. And it's how you break through a line. They're the men that are going to be on the front lines, the ones who are first in, the ones who break the lines. That's who the spearmen are. Lysias has 40 unarmed Sadducean Jews who have a plot. And he pulls together 200 foot soldiers, 70 cavalry, and 200 spearmen. Nothing's going to happen to Paul. Look at how God takes care of his own. Do you see that? I mean, do you just take a step back for a moment and just sit there going and just kind of smiling to yourself to go, God has his hands around his servant. This tribune is making sure Paul's going to get there safely. And the cavalry are only used oftentimes in Rome to escort important VIPs through the empire when they need to move somewhere quickly. Otherwise, they would have tons of foot soldiers around them. But when they move them quickly, they would have cavalry. Do you know that a Caesar would garner 200 cavalry? That's a Caesar. Paul gets 70. When you have 70 cavalry, 200 foot soldiers, and 200 spearmen, you're going to gather some attention. People are going to go, who just came into town? Who's here? So he pulls all of these together. It's basically, when you have the cavalry there, it's an indication that all of Rome's power and might is protecting someone that's in this group. And so he tells these two centurions, get your 200 infantry ready, get the spearmen ready, get the horsemen ready, and make a mount for Paul. Have them ready to leave at the third hour of the night. Here's another one. This is like, oh, this is, anyone that's ever been a troop goes, oh, great. Of course it's going to be the third hour of the night. You don't even get to go and get a good night's sleep before we go. The third hour of the night, understand this is a Roman speaking to a Roman, so it's going to be Roman time. This means have everyone ready to leave at 3 a.m. 3 a.m. is when I want you to pull out. He's moving Paul out in the middle of the night. He provides a mount for Paul to ride. Their mission, bring Paul safely to Felix, the governor in Caesarea. And then he writes a letter to Felix. And listen how he writes this letter. He uses the form of the day in the same way that Paul does, right? He begins with Claudius Lysias, right? Paul, if you read the letters, what does he always start with? Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ. Letters in that day basically start with, this is who it's from. I want you to know right off the bat when you're reading the letter, this is who sent it to you. And so he starts off with Claudius Lysias. It's from me. To His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. And then he gets right to the point. One, this man was seized by the Jews and about to be killed by them, but I came with soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Not quite exactly how that happened if you look back, right? And what you want to see here is Lysias now is taking advantage of the opportunity for a little self-protection. He colors this just a little bit to show that he basically came and rescued him from the clutches of the Jews. He forgets to tell him that he almost scourged him. But that doesn't need to hit the letter. You know what I love about that? It tells you this is a real letter. Right? Any of you that's in business, any of you that are involved in this, you know exactly why he wrote it that way, and you knew what he wrote was exactly what he wanted to do. The intention that he was trying to give was, hey, I'm a good guy in this, but there's something else that he does by writing it this way. Who else does he write as a good guy? Paul. This letter isn't a letter saying, treat this guy poorly. First thing he says is, I rescued him from the Jews. Second thing he says, I wanted to know their charge, and so I brought him down to their council. Turns out it's some issue concerning their law and customs, some Jewish thing. Not significant, right? It's nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. So right off the bat, that's what he tells, you know, the governor. I don't think he even needs to be imprisoned. And so Lysias would be going, well, then why did you send him to me? Well, third, it was disclosed that they were plotting to kill him, and so I sent him to you at once, ordering also his accusers to state before you what they have against him. There was a plot against him, and that's why I needed to get him out of Jerusalem right now. I'm going to let them know if they want to bring a charge, they bring it in front of you. And what's Lysias hoping? One, that the governor's going to be lenient on Paul, take care of him. Two, that these Jews aren't going to want to go to Caesarea and go in front of the governor, because if you falsely accuse someone in front of the governor, the consequences are pretty high. And so he thinks maybe this whole thing will blow over. But what I want you to see in this letter that's written by Lysias, he gets Paul out of Jerusalem. He basically is kind of hoping that the Jews may let this go, and he's letting Felix know that Paul should also be let go. He definitely paints Paul in a positive light. This is where in the series this week I started to praise God. To recognize that God can change how people write letters. God can change all these different factors to the point where Paul's going to get fairly good treatment. He's treated like a VIP as he's moved through the middle of the night, you know, over to this place. And what's interesting to me is that Lysias is not even aware of how beautifully he's carrying out God's will. He thinks he's doing something that's self-preserving. He thinks he's doing something that might be good for Paul. He's thinking this is going to be something that's going to bring peace. He has no clue to the fact that he's carrying out God's will in getting Paul to Rome. Paul is escorted not only to Rome on his own, he's escorted by 70 Roman horsemen. He's brought into Caesarea basically as a rock star. Who's here? Who's come to town? This is where I think of the Proverbs 21:1 that Bren read. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. But not only Lysias. This is where I think the irony is kind of funny. Even the plotting Jews who are wanting to kill this Paul, swearing to get it done quickly, and they want to just stop the whole expansion of the gospel, unwittingly just worked for God to do just the opposite. They just helped Paul get to Rome, the capital of the empire. 300 years later, Christianity would be basically the religion of the empire, and would be carried out to the corners of the earth. They thought they just wanted to kill this guy. God said, I'll use that. Later in Rome, Paul would write to the Philippian church that there were those in Caesar's household who were now believers, sending their love with him in his letter. Do you see the result? When he gets here to Rome, there's people in Caesar's household. Think about all the soldiers, the centurions on the way. Think of all of the folks over the next 4 years that Paul's going to be with, both in Caesarea for a couple of years and then in Rome for a couple of years, both times being under house arrest with no restraints on who could visit him and basically who he could talk to. Think about the impact that Paul had, centurions, the military, who would rise up in power and grace, and you start to understand how the Lord was changing the entire dynamic by moving Paul to Rome. So, verse 31, the soldiers follow the orders. They make it to Antipatris the following night. You need to understand, that's 42 miles away. They marched, these 400 foot soldiers, 42 miles in a day. He wanted them moving pretty quickly. They can do it. Usually you figure you can only get a foot soldier about 30 miles in a day on a normal clip. And so he had them advancing the clip. And so they basically got there. And then basically when they got him there to Antipatris, that's in Samaria, which they figured the Jews, he was safer. So then all of the foot soldiers and the spearmen come back to the fort, and the horsemen took Paul forward to Caesarea. They delivered this letter with Paul to Felix. Felix reads the letter. The only thing, question he asked is, which province is he from? Why is he asking that question? Because hopefully he's from a province that's not under my jurisdiction and I can pass this off to someone else. That's every bureaucrat's desire, is to be able to move it off of your desk onto somebody else's desk. Cilicia, huh? All right, that's in my jurisdiction. I'll give you a trial when your accusers arrive. In the meantime, I want him held in Herod's Praetorium. I want you to understand, Herod's Praetorium is not a prison. That is an officer's barracks. That was what Herod, basically, the other name for it is Herod's Palace. I want him held in Herod's Palace. I want him held there under house arrest. Being placed on house arrest, if you were going to be placed on house arrest, Herod's Palace would probably not be a bad place to be put on house arrest. Next week, we'll find a contingent from Jerusalem comes to accuse Paul. I want you to see this morning that the 40 murderers plotting against him, the Jewish leaders complicit in the plot, Lysias, the commanding officer, centurions, soldiers, spearmen, and cavalry, even Governor Felix, all plotting, planning, directing, deciding, while all the while, our God is working all of these things together for his purpose. His will would be done. He told Paul that 2 nights ago. Your work here is done. I'm moving you to Rome. Paul had no idea he was going to be escorted by 40 cavalry. Why is he going to Rome? We've read the book. The gospel's going to the nations, every corner of the world. Beloved, I want you to turn off the news. God has it all in hand. If you do watch, I want you to remember something. They all meant it for evil, but God uses it for his good, his purposes. And I'll basically kind of give you a disclaimer. I'm going to give you the ending before you read through it, before it comes. It's a happy ending. Well, it's a happy ending for all those who believe, all those who trust in this God, all those who believe in the Savior that he sent, his son, Christ. It's a happy ending. It all works out in the end. And we can rest assured in that. And no matter what comes this week, the news we get from a doctor, the flyover of Japan, the nuclear sends, you know, that North Korea sends in the air, some terrorist attack somewhere in the world, some Ebola outbreak. I didn't put Ebola in there. The Ebola outbreak, over 1,000 now. It's expanded outside of their barriers. Ooh. It's all in his hand. Every single thing that's happening around the world, not one thing is happening outside of his overall control, his authority. And it's all being done in order to project forward his plan towards the happy ending, which is Christ's return, and all those whom God loved being reconciled and brought home to him.